This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Few political figures on the international stage today have generated more speculation and intrigue than Russian President Vladimir Putin. As the United States contends with Russian aggression in Crimea and Ukraine and airstrikes in Syria, the man at the center of these high-stakes foreign policy maneuvers continues to defy easy political analysis. Our guest today, Brookings Institution senior scholar Fiona Hill, says this is because policymakers don't grasp the multiple real Putin identities, survivalist, free marketeer, and case officer, among others, that define both the means and ends of his politics. As a result, Putin's personal brand of presidential leadership and the opaque nature of Kremlin decision-making are likely to keep American officials guessing for the foreseeable future. Today on The Exchange, we're taking a close look at Russian President Vladimir Putin. Let's hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And joining me this morning from Washington, D.C. to talk about Vladimir Putin is Fiona Hill. Fiona is a senior fellow and director of the Center of the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. She's co-author of the book Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. Fiona will be giving a public talk and book signing tomorrow evening at 6:30 p.m. at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College. And Fiona, thanks so much for joining us for The Exchange.
Thanks so much, Dean. Great to be here this morning.
There's so much to talk about with Vladimir Putin. He's such a fascinating figure. Let's start with a little background on his rise to power. Most people know that he was in the KGB, but that's usually about all they know. So could you give our listeners just a thumbnail sketch of his rise to power?
Absolutely. I mean, the first thing to say about Vladimir Putin is that his rise to power was somewhat unusual for someone of his background to basically become the president of Russia is actually fairly strange, in spite of the fact that the KGB, and certainly in popular law, is one of the central institutions of the old Soviet Union. Putin didn't rise up through the ranks of the Communist Party like his predecessors did before him, Boris Yeltsin and Mikhail Gorbachev, who was, of course, the last leader of the Soviet Union. And Boris Yeltsin was the first president of a new Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. He, in many respects, came up through the back corridors, a very unlikely rise from very humble background. His parents weren't part of the Soviet intelligentsia or the elite. He lived in a communal apartment, which is the equivalent of a rather sprawling public housing complex in St. Petersburg, what was then Leningrad. Grew up after World War II in a family who had gone through one of the worst episodes of World War II in the Soviet Union, the siege of Leningrad, which lasted for several years and saw almost a million people die, either from starvation and the deprivations and horrors of the siege, as well as from the bombardment by German forces. His parents lost their older son, Vladimir Putin's brother. So he kind of grew up in a family in the 1950s after the war that was very much scarred by this experience, and it made a huge impression on him. And he actually started to learn German in that period, you know, possibly as part of the exercise of trying to come to terms with what had happened in the war. He started to learn German in high school. He showed an early interest in joining the KGB. He even went, according to himself and some other stories about him, when he was in high school to the local KGB headquarters and asked about how he should join the organisation. And they told him to go and get a law degree. I suppose that'll probably make all the lawyers shudder right now, that they obviously saw that as a rather useful skill set to become a member of the KGB. He ends up in Leningrad State University, one of the top universities in the law faculty there. And there he makes a series of very important connections for later on in his career. One of his professors at the law school is Anatoly Sobchak, who much later becomes the first democratically elected mayor of St. Petersburg in the waning days of the Soviet Union, in the first early days of the new Russia. In the meantime, after graduating from the law faculty, he does indeed join the KGB at a very critical time in the 1970s, when the KGB is dealing with the dissident movement that has grown up in the Soviet Union and is run by Yuri Andropov, who would himself later become the head of the Communist Party and of the Soviet Union. And in the 1980s, at another critical period, when perestroika is taking place and Mikhail Gorbachev has just ascended to the head of the Communist Party and the head of the USSR, Putin is assigned to Dresden in East Germany with the KGB, taking advantage of his German language skills. And there he actually experiences the whole collapse of East Germany and the fall of the Berlin Wall. And he misses completely perestroika and all of the big changes that are happening inside of the Soviet Union. When he goes back in 1990 to what's still Leningrad, but shifting over to become St. Petersburg with all the renaming of the cities in the Soviet Union, he sees that everything is collapsing. And he says himself in his own autobiographical materials that he was just really thrown for a loop. He didn't really know what to do with himself. And then he gets a job with his old law professor on the campaign for the law professor, Anatoly Sobchak, to become the mayor of St. Petersburg. He then becomes the deputy mayor to Anatoly Sobchak, and he becomes in charge of international economic deals with foreign businesses. And then in 1996, Anatoly Sobchak loses his re-election bid to become mayor, and Vladimir Putin's out of a job. And some of his colleagues, this all sounds kind of, I think, rather familiar when you think about US politics, about how these things change and, you know, people attach themselves to campaigns and, mm-hmm. you know, get positions through these various connections. Well, this is really the story of Vladimir Putin. Several of his colleagues have gone off to work in Moscow for Boris Yeltsin. They're mm-hmm. part of the economic reformers around Yeltsin in the 1990s, trying to basically put the Russian economy back on its feet after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And one of them, Alexei Kudrin, recommends Putin for a job inside the Kremlin, looking after the Kremlin property, which is all of the buildings and cars and aeroplanes and all of the paraphernalia that the Kremlin owns, which is actually rather a lot. It's quite a responsible
job. So Fiona, he gets this job in 96 looking after the property, but then we have this whirlwind period of just a couple years, and then he's basically leading the country by 2000. Is that correct?
That's exactly it. There's a long lead up to this. Yeah. And, you know, then suddenly, within a blink of an
rise.
Eye, practically in 2 years, he's the president. And he goes from being in the property agency to being in charge of a financial oversight body, you know, really kind of getting into the weeds of who's been doing what with whom on a financial side, you know, putting his KGB skills to the test to look out for malfeasance in, you know, people handling property and finances. Next thing, he's the head of the KGB, an organization that he'd had a fairly lowly position in before. And then he's the acting prime minister, he's the prime minister, he's the acting president, he's the president.
Yeah. You mentioned in your book that this is rapid period and that it's really kind of difficult to get a sense of you know, why did the dominoes kind of line up for him in this way? What's your sense of you know, what were the one or two kind of factors? Was it all just he was in the right place at the right time? Was he a skilled political operator? How did he make that incredible jump in just really 3 or 4 years?
I think it's a combination of both of those things. If we all think about our own, you know, life choices, often a lot of them are by chance. It's who you meet at what time. But in many cases, with somebody who does become such a successful politician, there's also an element of skill. And I think that's the main thing to remember about Vladimir Putin. A lot of people assume that he was some kind of mediocrity right from, you know, the beginning of the presidency. And even when he was deputy mayor of Moscow, of St. Petersburg, rather, people were rather disparaging of him. He was the guy behind the scenes. He was Sobchak's fix-it man. He was always, you know, doing the deal for Sobchak. But in actual fact, he seems to have had a very good knack of collecting people, collecting information on people, knowing how to work with people, and knowing how to keep his true intentions rather well hidden, which, of course, one would think would be very good skills that you would learn within the KGB. And by using those skills, taking advantage of every opportunity he was afforded, walking through every door that was opened, and keeping rather quiet about his ambitions, he rose to the top.
Yeah, both sounds like he's both tactical and strategic, kind of keeping his eye on a longer-term trajectory. Do you have a sense of the impact on his leadership style of the breakup of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War? I know you mentioned he misses perestroika. He sees the collapse of East Germany. What is your sense of how this sort of tumultuous period in the late 80s and early 90s influenced his kind of view of leadership?
Well, Putin's quite unique in this background of coming up through the back corridors, but he's not unique in his politics. He's actually a rather traditional conservative politician. Again, he wouldn't really be out of place in some of his views in any other political context that we can think of. He's very much a Russian patriot. One of the reasons that he was so interested in joining the KGB when he was a young man was partly the perceived glamour of the institution, but also because the KGB saw itself as the sword and the shield. That's its motto and its emblem of the Soviet state. It's the protector of the state. And when he becomes the president in 2000, and just as he's moving into that position, he makes a really big speech talking about himself as a statist, someone who wants to protect the interests of the state, a traditional conservative, and he wants to put Russia back on its feet. And at many times he's spoken about how it wasn't just a great personal tragedy for him, but how it was a huge catastrophe. I mean, people might remember that he said that in a speech about a decade ago about the Soviet Union, that it was the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century, the collapse of the Soviet Union. And he meant not the communist system or, you know, the five-year plans or, you know, any of the things that we often associate with the Soviet Union, but the collapse of the state. He talks often about the shock of being in East Germany, which was supposed to be the most progressive, advanced and economically prosperous part of the Soviet bloc, and finding it was completely falling apart. And as missing perestroika by being in Dresden from essentially 1985 to 1990, which is the peak of the Gorbachev period that all of us from the outside, you know, were watching with such amazement and eagerness and, you know, kind of really just seeing these great, what we thought were very positive changes, Putin didn't see any of that. He came back and found the Soviet Union was just on its knees and on the verge of collapse, which it duly did, you know, not long after he came back by the end of 1991. So for him, it was that whole certainty of a career which was set to defend the state, seeing himself as a patriot, seeing himself as somebody who wanted to serve the state and finding that state disappear. And it's something that's really defined him. You know, there's all kinds of various accusations about Putin and he's more interested in his own, you know, personal prosperity, the people around him. But a very consistent theme from Putin all the way through has been this interest in preserving, defending the Russian state and putting the Russian state back on its feet.
Yeah, that's not something you typically hear about here when you hear discussions of Vladimir Putin. I want to let our listeners know that we're talking about Russian President Vladimir Putin today. My guest is Fiona Hill. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-author of the book Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. And you can reach us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, and let us know what you think about Russia and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Fiona, let's shift now and just spend a little bit of time talking about the thesis in your book, this idea of one of the problems that policymakers and decision makers here and elsewhere have is that they don't really grasp these sort of multiple Putin identities that all seem to kind of drive his behavior and his goals and means. But before we actually talk about the six identities, could you just say a few words about the challenges of doing this kind of research on Russia? In your book, you mention about how complex it is to actually sometimes get at the reality of a situation when doing this kind of research.
Yes, it's very difficult with someone like Vladimir Putin, who, you know, he's been in the public spotlight for an extremely long time right now. But in actual fact, we have almost no real concrete biographical information on him, even now, you know, particularly in an atmosphere when, you know, in the West, we're so used to every single issue, you know, related to a political personality being pored over. We have Hillary Clinton's emails out there for everyone to read right now. The idea of having anything like that about Vladimir Putin is just rather preposterous, because in having been in the KGB, he's obviously been well trained to hide his identity, to conceal facts about himself. He, you know, at different points seems to have worked as a recruiter for, you know, agents, or at least, you know, certainly trying to blackmail and manipulate, you know, people that the KGB wanted to have as agents. And in those kinds of instances, the person who's doing this, the operative, really tries to conceal everything about themselves and elicit information from other people. So this is really the style of leadership about Putin. Every time you think you have a piece of information about him, there are several different versions of the same story, many told by Putin himself. We spent a lot of time going back over all the biographical statements about Putin, all the biographies in Russia and a couple of other languages about him, and you'll find incredible discrepancies in all of the stories. There's actually a very good biography that's just been written by New York Times correspondent Steve Lee Myers about Putin, which is, you know, proper chronological biography, which tries to get to the heart of all of these stories. But we were trying to figure out what makes this guy tick. What would a policymaker need to know if they're dealing with Putin? Mm-hmm. And especially if we can't get to the heart of some of the biographical information, which usually people tend to rely on, what's the context? What right. do we know about Russia and the Soviet Union in the time that Putin has been living there? The various factors that might have shaped his career? Because actually, there's quite a lot of information out there, surprisingly, about the KGB. When he joined it in the 1970s and 1980s, we know a lot about the period of perestroika. We know a lot about what was going on in East Germany when he was stationed there. And actually, we know quite a lot about what the Soviet Union was like in the 1950s, 1960s when he was growing up.
So you almost have to build like a kind of a circumstantial case around him. And that's kind of informs your actual view of him as a decision maker.
Yeah, that's a great way of looking at it. That's exactly it. It's kind of like a circumstantial case. And to try to figure out, if we can't figure out exactly what he is thinking, then what are other people around him thinking and doing and saying about things, so that we can then examine him in that context. Mm-hmm. And also, we spent a lot of time looking at things that Putin himself has said. There's a lot of discrepancies, but other times there's actually a lot of consistency.
Mm-hmm. Fiona, let's go to the phones. And we have Tom joining us from Littleton. Tom, welcome to The Exchange.
How's it going, everybody? Good morning.
Good morning.
Excellent. I had read a book about 5-6 years ago called A Man Without a Face. Are you familiar with that book?
I am, very much so. By Masha Gessen, yes, absolutely.
Yes. The name was beginning me. And I think I would sort of tend to agree with you, but I would say that I would hesitate that he's sort of a totalitarian and a patriot at the same time. I mean, he's kind of reading her book, the awful things that he's purported to do, there's not necessarily proof, but murdering opponents and sabotaging elections and just, I mean, I think he is a patriot and he does want to do the best thing, but his motives are just so suspect.
What do you think, Fiona?
Well, I think, you know, there's different ways of looking at this. And, you know, I think we always have to be very careful when we're dealing with a subject like Vladimir Putin. Masha Gessen's book came out just a little bit before ours. I know Masha very well. She's a very distinguished journalist and a Russian-American. And she herself was actually part of the opposition to Putin. So the book is as much about her as a member of the Russian opposition and about her own experiences of going back to Russia, having lived in the US for a long time. It's a really interesting book of that regard of, you know, really puts you in the time and the place. And she does spend a lot of time, obviously, talking about the kind of dirty tricks, which one would imagine are the stock in trade of a KGB operative. And this is an important element of Putin's biography. He's the kind of person, having been trained in the KGB, to do whatever is necessary to basically protect his interests and to promote the interests of Russia, and obviously to keep the political system around him in place. And, you know, the methods and tendencies that he adopts, the methods of repression on the political front, are very clearly right out of the KGB handbook.
Yeah, Fiona, I have to hold you just for a moment. We need to take a short break. But after the break, there'll be lots more on Vladimir Putin's many identities. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis in for Laura Kanoy. Today on The Exchange, we're talking with a leading Putinologist about Russia's leader, Vladimir Putin. And we want you to call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. My guest today is Fiona Hill. She's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-author of Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. And she'll be giving a talk and a book signing tomorrow night, 6:30 p.m. at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College. And Fiona, let's spend a little bit of time now talking about the thesis of your book in these six identities. And maybe, you know, you can use them in the context of talking a little bit about the recent reannexation of Crimea and the aggression in the Ukraine.
Yes, and Tom's question, the last caller, was also, you know, an important one to pivot from. Because, you know, he was obviously stressing what he'd taken away from another book about Putin, you know, about being really the, you know, the KGB operative, really engaged in repression of dissent and, as he put it, also, you know, manipulating elections and, you know, what were the motivations there. And at the point of writing the book from several different dimensions of putting Putin in different contexts is that there's more to Putin than just one particular perspective. And as we were really directing the book towards policymakers and people who have to deal with Russia, not just to, you know, more of a general audience, we wanted to make the point, my co-author and I, Clifford Gaddy, that we should be very careful about drawing assumptions and conclusions from just one aspect of thinking about Putin as the KGB, former KGB agent. He's a very complex person, as everybody is, and he's operating in a very specific context. This book is not just about Putin. It's about Russia, and it's about the late Soviet period. Clifford Gaddy, my colleague, is an economist, a very distinguished economist who's been studying the Soviet economy basically since the late 1960s. And I'm trained as a historian. So I've, you know, basically been steeped in Russian history, you know, since the early modern period. So Putin himself is steeped in that same context. One of the very interesting things about Putin is how obsessed he is about Russian history. He talks about himself as a student of history. There's no evidence that he's actually taken any formal history classes. So he's a sort of a self-taught autodidact on Russian history, an omnivorous reader. His press people are always talking about Putin reading books about Russian history. They're Russian history books by Russian authors. And Putin is certainly obsessed about the Russian czars. In many respects, he sees the Russian presidency as a constitutional monarchy. And interestingly enough, his law professor from Leningrad, the deputy, the mayor of St. Petersburg that he was the deputy to, Anatoly Sobchak, was a constitutional scholar looking at the efforts during the Russian Tsarist era to create a constitutional monarchy around the Tsar. And Sobchak was also one of the people who drew up the new Russian constitution in the 1990s, which really cemented the president as the center of all of political activity in Russia. The president and the constitution stand above every other institution in Russia. There are really no other checks and balances on this. So Putin is very much fixated on the centrality of the one leader in the Russian state, be it the Tsar, you know, to some degree the head of the Communist Party and the head of the Soviet Union, and now the Russian president. He is very much informed by Russian history and his reading of Russian history. He's informed by the training that he had in the KGB. He's very much informed by his own family's personal experience of going through this terrible experience of World War II and the siege of Leningrad. He describes himself as a survivor and the child of survivors. And he talks about a survivor's or a survivalist mentality, somebody who's experienced the worst and has to always prepare for the worst and always be ready to depend on themselves and use their own resources and not depend on anyone else for the future. And all of this really culminates in the annexation of Crimea in 2014. Mm-hmm. Putin makes this speech to stop the annexation of Crimea from Ukraine in March of 2014, which puts all of this together. He basically talks about Russia and its long history of invasions from the West, and Russia always being pushed into a corner, everyone always trying to contain, constrain and confront Russia. It's basically a speech about grievance, personal grievance, national grievance, and a feeling that he is putting everything right again by taking Crimea back from Ukraine. Ukraine had wrongfully acquired Crimea at the end of the Soviet Union.
Right.
Crimea had been transferred by Nikita Khrushchev, former General Secretary of the Communist Party, in the 1950s from the Russian Federation to Ukraine. Putin describes this as all unfair. It's a purely nationalist, populist speech, but bringing in an awful lot of personal aspects to this. It's the kind of speech that, you know, you would find in many other settings.
So,
it's, you know, the presidential candidate speech almost, you know, putting everything together in one big ball.
So you see, you're basically seeing all of these multiple identities at work in this particular speech and in the idea that by restoring Crimea to Russia, that is kind of a reassertion of Russian identity.
Absolutely right. And in a way, it's kind of like the ultimate culmination of Vladimir Putin's career. You know, he goes from being, you know, the young guy from the back streets of Leningrad, who sees then a surprising rise within the institutions of the Soviet Union. He sees the state collapse, and then he's putting everything back again. When he comes back to when he becomes into the presidency, he talks about putting Russia back on its feet, restoring the state and restoring its international position. And with Crimea, he says he's done that. Frankly, that will probably be his legacy. We'll remember Putin, basically, and I'm sure he was incredibly aware of that as he gave this speech, for taking Crimea from Ukraine and putting it back, as he says, into the Russian Federation where it belongs.
It certainly got the attention of the international community.
Yeah, it certainly did.
Fiona, we've had several listeners email in, focusing on some of our discussion in the first part of the show, and they want to comment on kind of Putin as a sort of the kind of the ruthless aspect, the kind of dirty player aspect of his persona. Francis from Bedford emailed and said, could you please comment on Frontline's recent portrayal of Putin as a ruthless, calculating, stone-cold killer, eliminating any and every person in Russia who dares to challenge him? And Richard from Milton emailed in and asked for you to comment on the whole issue of Alexander Litvinenko and whether or not he was poisoned with polonium-210. So some of our listeners kind of wanting you to weigh a little bit more on the sort of ruthless aspect of what we know about Vladimir Putin.
Yes. Obviously, Putin's whole career in the KGB has been a very important element of his persona. And we have to be, you know, very much aware of what the KGB stood for and what it is now in the form of the FSB, you know, the successor agency to the KGB, which is essentially the same entity, but renamed since the collapse of the Soviet Union. There's an awful lot of literature out there about the institution, so I'm not going to say anything that I think is especially surprising. Mm-hmm. But certainly during the Cold War, there were many different things that the KGB did. They stole technological secrets, and when Vladimir Putin was out in Dresden, there was a large operation underway out there to steal secrets from German industry to try to get hold of the various codes to crack the secret information channels of the United States operating in Western Europe to get the CIA codes to tap into telephone lines and secure communications. There was all kinds of efforts to do what we used to call honey traps or sting operations to target Western businessmen and diplomats to basically turn them into assets by exploiting and taking advantage of things that they did, like engaging in illicit currency exchange when it was illegal to change the ruble outside of official channels. If they were caught with prostitutes, if they were caught making illegal black market transactions for contraband goods in the Soviet Union, a lot of people have forgotten, you know, how restricted the Soviet economy and its transactions were. And Vladimir Putin joining the KGB in the 1970s in a city like Leningrad, you know, modern-day St. Petersburg, would have been involved in all of these things, and especially so when he's sent to Dresden. Dresden as well. The opposition to the East German leader, Erich Honecker, was being closely scrutinized. There was all kinds of things going on in the KGB, and there was also the repression of dissidents at home in the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. The 1970s is the period when the Communist Party was completely paranoid about basically the opposition to its rule from the intelligentsia, the Russian intellectuals and opposition movement that was rising up. And especially after the upheavals in Hungary and then in Czechoslovakia with the Prague Spring, they were worried about the same kinds of activity going on in Soviet Union itself. So the KGB was repressing opposition. Mm-hmm. They were also assassinating political opponents. So if anybody was a traitor to the KGB during the Cold War, that was obviously the highest infraction that anyone could possibly commit, was becoming a double agent and then betraying your country to the enemy. And Putin continues to think in this way, mm-hmm. and so do the people around him. Frankly, the KGB continues to operate in many respects in the same fashions that it did during the Soviet period.
So what do you make of this Alexander Litvinenko situation? I'm trying to remember if the U.S. and or Great Britain have said anything in particular about it.
Well, there's just been a public inquest in the United Kingdom, where the report from the inquest was recently released. Public inquiries in Britain, which are usually carried out by the courts, take an awfully long time to percolate through the system. And so this has been many years in the making. And basically, all available information is supposed to be submitted to the court for review. So an awful lot of information about the Litvinenko case has been aired in public. And the conclusion of the presiding judge was that obviously the Russian intelligence services were behind the assassination of Litvinenko, and they conclude that Putin probably knew about this. Mm. I mean, I don't think there's anything especially surprising, unfortunately,
right.
About any of this. Litvinenko was very clearly and was already laid out an operative within the KGB himself. At different times, he appears to have played the role of a double agent, and he's certainly been deemed to have been a traitor by the Russian intelligence services.
I think it is
shocking for us from the outside that they continue to do this. But as far as the Russians are concerned, why would they not? I mean,
right.
There's a very deep cynicism about this. But Putin has never lied about the fact that he was in the intelligence services and that he believes that the intelligence services continue to do their work.
I want to tell our listeners we're talking about Russian President Vladimir Putin today. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us exchange@nhpr.org, which many of you are doing, and find us on Facebook and Twitter. My guest is Fiona Hill. She is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-author of Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. And Fiona, let's shift gears a little bit here and talk about Russia and the United States specifically. And I want to start with maybe some distinctions between Putin and George W. Bush versus Putin and Barack Obama. We all know that famous moment where early in his presidency, George W. Bush said he looked Putin in the eye and glimpsed his soul, and he was somewhat ridiculed for that, but he stood by it initially. And President Obama seems to be a bit more aloof in dealing with him. So although I understand, and we'll talk in a moment, that they had a phone conversation yesterday about this partial truce in Syria. So let's just some your initial thoughts about Bush and Obama and how they related to Putin.
Well, interestingly enough, this really comes out of the response to the last question. There are, for us from the outside, very shocking aspects about Putin, based on his career in the KGB, the incredibly, nasty, dirty tricks that the KGB carried out and, has really continued in its new incarnation of the FSB. But there's another aspect of Putin's training in the KGB, which is, as he says, working with people and working with information, which is looking for ways in which you can really personalize relationships and target everybody as if they might be an asset. In a way, Putin tries to recruit international leaders, just as he really personalizes all of his interactions in the Russian domestic scene. I mean, everything in Russia is highly personal. the whole of politics is very informal. The state institutions don't really matter all of that much. Everything is about Putin and relationships with Putin. And that's exactly how he interacts on the world stage. So with George W. Bush, you can be very certain that that first encounter, Putin was trying to figure out how he could essentially recruit Bush. What in Bush's biography could he draw upon to kind of create a commonality, something that he could exploit later on to pull Bush closer to him in a relationship? He touched upon Bush's very open evangelical Christian perspective, the fact that Bush was a reformed alcoholic all out in public, and something that Bush himself had talked about very frequently, and that how he had basically found religion again. And Putin really played upon that, and I think that was very much part of that element of that surprisingly personal outburst by George W. Bush. Although much later, Bush himself clarified that he was also trying to find some commonality with Putin, to find a way of working with him. So it was very much a two-way street there. And I don't think that at any point George Bush really succumbed to this. And he was quite clear himself about how difficult a person Putin was. Now, with Barack Obama, as we well know about President Obama, he's not a very personable individual in terms of he has a very small circle of close friends. He's not really into the kind of black slapping bonhomie that most politicians are. He keeps himself to himself. He doesn't really kind of engage in personalized relationships either in the larger domestic political arena in the US or internationally. So he's actually been a more difficult target for Putin. And you can actually see that Putin's kind of given up on him. In spite of the numerous phone calls, which are inevitable when you have a political system like you do in Russia, where everything revolves around the one person on top who you absolutely have to speak to because that's where all the power lies, there hasn't been a lot of interactions between Putin and Obama. Putin left a lot of those personal interactions with the president to Dmitry Medvedev, Putin's close associate, who's still the Russian prime minister, but was president
for a
period.
Briefly.
That's right.
Yeah.
Very confusing.
It is.
between 2008 and 2012. And, basically, Obama and Medvedev on the surface have, more in common. Same generation. They were both law students, obviously in different contexts. But Medvedev didn't join the KGB after law school. He went into private practice. Medvedev was the son of two professors. And he's a much warmer personality, more modern, in his outlook in terms of, his familiarity with, technology. And, he's always on the iPhone, same as President Obama, has kind of embraced technology, all these kinds of things. And so, Putin basically deferred the relationship with President Obama to Medvedev for a whole period.
Right.
So Putin's found Obama quite difficult to deal with.
Yeah. Fiona, we had a caller check in with us off air, and he asked a question or wanted me to ask a question that I'm interested in. I'm always surprised to hear people refer to Putin as a billionaire. Could you say something about his wealth?
Well, this is one of the great big issues, the huge gorilla in the room of Russian politics. There is an awful lot of information out there about Putin's purported personal wealth. There is a recent book by U.S. Professor Karen Dowisher called Putin's Kleptocracy, which documents all of the available information about this. One of the popular images of Putin and his inner circle is that this is Putin and his crony, the collective, Putin and his pals, who have basically availed themselves of the centrality of the presidency in Russian politics, essentially just to amass money. But, there's an awful lot more to that story as well, because a lot of the stories about Putin's billions
come from the Kremlin itself. Yeah, let me jump in one second. We have to take one more break. We'll pick this up right after the break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis in for Laura Kanoy. Today, we're taking a closer look at Russian President Vladimir Putin. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange at nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. My guest for the hour today is Fiona Hill. She's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-author of the book Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. And Fiona will be doing a talk and book signing tomorrow night at 6:30 p.m. at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College. And Fiona, before the break, we were talking about Vladimir Putin's wealth. People sometimes say he's a billionaire, and I want you to finish up on that. But then could we also segue and talk a little bit about kind of his domestic popularity, which, as we know, given some of the domestic protests in previous years, has kind of fluctuated dramatically over his time in office?
Yes, thanks, Dean. It's a very good question about, you know, what's the whole story about Putin and, you know, the purported billions. A lot of the stories, interestingly, about this come from circles around the Kremlin, you know, almost as if there were leaks. But at the same time, there might be some other larger purpose about this. If, you know, we think about any context, what is money? Money is power. And money is also an emblem of success. Let's just say it's playing out in our own presidential elections in a rather ostentatious way right now. There's a certain amount of shock and awe about having billions. There's also the fact that Putin started off in the Kremlin Property Agency when he moved to Moscow in 1996. The Kremlin is an incredibly rich entity. It has every imaginable building, boats, ships, planes, automobiles, holiday homes, hospitals, all kinds of complexes attached to it. There is no written undertaking that if you're president of Russia that you can't accept gifts of a certain amount either and have to, you know, hand them over, which, you know, is a staple of our political system. Putin famously has all kinds of watches and, you know, amazing suits and driving around in all kinds of cars. In the Soviet period, a lot of this was the perks of being a member of the Communist Party and being in the Soviet Politburo of the higher echelons of the Soviet power. And there's still a very strong element of that in Russia today. There's a strong idea that those are the people who run the country get rewarded for running the country. Mm-hmm. It's surprisingly open, the discussion of the top people rewarding themselves. And, you know, though there's an awful lot of circumstantial evidence to suggest that Putin lives in a high degree of luxury, in many respects, that's what people would expect as being president of Russia with all of the assets available to him. There are many stories, as I said, there's a book that documents an awful lot about this. But there's no real hard evidence at this particular point about, you know, kind of how much money Putin has or doesn't have. And as I said, a lot of the stories come out from those circles around Putin himself, which suggests that there's an element of pushing people off by saying Putin has so much money that he's untouchable, that no one can influence him. And this is also against the backdrop of the fact that in the 1980s and 1990s, the Soviet state and then the Russian state were broke.
Right.
That Gorbachev and Yeltsin were looking at a bankrupt state entity, and that Yeltsin himself had to make deals with top Russian businessmen in the 1990s to get reelected.
Right.
Now the Kremlin has more money, and the idea is that Putin is the richest man on earth, and so no one can touch them. So, you know, it's a very complicated issue again. I mean, nothing is that simple in the Russian context.
So how does all this play out in terms of his popularity? My understanding is he's very popular now, but he had protests of several years ago, and so he's kind of fluctuated.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting because none of these stories about Russia's or Putin's wealth have really played that strongly with the Russian population. They don't seem to be especially interested. We're much more interested about this on the outside. You know, the frontline documentaries and others are not the kind of thing that might necessarily resonate in Russia. And that's because Putin is judged on his performance as president, about what he's done for the Russians themselves. His popularity is up in the upper 80s right now. It's definitely fluctuated in the past. Before the annexation of Crimea and before the Sochi Winter Olympics, it was down in the low to mid 60s. Now, down to low to mid 60s sounds, you know, still incredible from the perspective of any
certainly
Western
by U.S.
politician.
Standards, right?
Certainly. But the point is that Russia is obviously rather a unique political system. There is no political alternative to Vladimir Putin. There's only him. There's no heir apparent lurking in the wings.
So we don't know what's coming next.
Exactly. We don't know what's coming next.
Okay.
There's no other political... I mean, there may well be someone in the wings, but we're not being told
about it,
obviously.
Not Medvedev?
Well, Medvedev would step in. If anything happened to Putin, you know, if he fell down a flight of stairs and, you know, basically was no longer with us, Medvedev would step into the presidential role again for a period, and then they would, you know, basically elect a new successor. Hmm. I would imagine they'll pick someone from, you know, the inner circle around Putin, someone who's more like Putin than not, as the case may be. There's definitely a mechanism there. But Putin himself right now has no opposition figure that anybody rates against him. There's no other political figure like Dmitry Medvedev or anyone else, frankly, in the inner circle that resonates with the population. So all of the ratings are based on Putin's present and past political performances and how people think he's doing. And frankly, they think he's doing pretty well. I mean, we may not, you know, be very happy with the things that Putin's doing, but he did for the whole period up until, I would say, about 2011, 2012, 2013, when Russia started to get affected like everyone else from the effects of the Great Recession and the Eurozone crisis in Europe, he did bring, as far as Russian people concerned, an unprecedented era of prosperity. He did that in many respects because he was very lucky with high oil prices, but it was also because they had a very safe, sensible, conservative fiscal policy in Russia. They were very careful about government spending and about paying off debt and you know, really emphasizing wage increases and welfare provisions for the average Russian. And since 2014 and the annexation of Crimea, which was a universally popular move inside of Russia, even people who were in opposition to Putin, who didn't like any of the other things that he'd done, especially the crackdown against the opposition after he came back into the presidency, and there were so many protests in the streets about people who wanted, you know, another choice, not just Putin all the time. you know, even they were bowled over by just the annexation of Crimea, because everybody felt, I wouldn't everybody, but most people felt that this was, you know, a real unfair outcome of the collapse of the Soviet Union. So now the question is, can he keep all of these ratings up? Many people say it's because of the wars in Ukraine and Syria. He's distracting the population. But there's still a strong element of people still like Putin.
Yeah, and I want to talk about Syria in a moment and the recent developments there. But before we do that, we had an email from Richard in Milton who wants to know about what it might be like to have a President Vladimir Putin and a President Donald Trump. Donald Trump is doing quite well as the Republican frontrunner in our 2016 race. And we also have Ron from Franconia joining us. Ron, welcome to The Exchange.
Yes, good morning. Recently, a radio broadcast quoted Mr. Putin as saying he could work with Mr. Trump. I'm wondering what your guest makes of that comment, how that fits into his six personalities, and why he would say that about Trump rather than other candidates. Thank you.
Yeah, great question, Ron. Fiona, what do you think?
Well, I think in many respects, and you know, one should always be very careful about how you frame this, that Putin and Trump have a very similar political style. Now, not at all the issues we were talking about you know, Putin and the dirty tricks from the KGB.
Right.
But Putin is a traditional conservative politician. He's also a populist. Putin is somebody who is very cognizant of what the Russian people feel. I mean, how Putin isn't really selling anything to Russians. What he's doing is defending all of the different positions that Russians have expressed through opinion polls that matter to them. And, of course, Donald Trump is doing something very similar, as all politicians do. They're reading the polls. They're looking at where people's grievances are. They're trying to kind of figure out what resonates, what messages resonate. And just like Trump has picked all kinds of different messages for different settings, Putin has done the same. Putin is also famously not politically correct.
Yeah, Trump's
Putin
kind of
uses languages that nobody would ever imagine, even in a Russian context.
And they're both kind of tough guys. They like to
and
sort
very
of
much
portray
tough
themselves.
Guys.
Yeah.
And they're also very interested in, you know, picking up the title of Trump's book, The Art of the Deal.
Right.
Putin is all about making a deal. And Putin is, in fact, looking for a deal constantly with the United States in particular on all kinds of different issues. I think, you know, he sees Donald Trump as being, you know, someone, you know, with the same outward perspective. And it's also, you know, that idea of really expressing clearly, you know, what he thinks, airing grievances, which is something that Putin does. The other thing is, however, that I'm sure Putin is quite convinced that he can exploit vulnerabilities about Trump because Trump has been so very transparent. I'm sure he thinks that about all of the candidates, frankly. He's probably watching, you know, very closely to look for openings that, you know, he can jump into to, you know, either create a new personalized relationship or exploit things.
Yeah,
you know, so that's kind of, you know, the modus operandi of Putin.
I was going to say it sounds a little bit like him figuring out how to approach George W. Bush back in 2000. Let's talk a little bit about Syria. Some news yesterday about at least a partial truce, and it sounds like you can kind of fit Russia's actions in Syria into the sort of larger, you know, analytic framework of Crimea and even, I guess, Georgia back in 2008. So, say a little bit about what's going on in Syria with Putin.
Well, first of all, with Syria, Putin has been extremely clear and very consistent since the start of the Syrian civil war that Russia supports the regime of Bashar Assad, that Russia has long-standing interests and a long-standing relationship with Syria and in the Middle East more broadly. But Syria has remained since the Soviet period a close ally of Moscow's. And Putin has repeatedly said that he is completely opposed to regime change, period. You know, obviously that wouldn't be a great surprise to anyone. And in the case of Syria, he was certainly determined to make sure that Assad didn't experience the same fate as Muammar Gaddafi did in Libya, a point that Putin has seemed to be deeply troubled by, of Gaddafi you know, being killed by rebel forces. And he was determined to make sure that Assad would stay in place. Right from the very beginning, Putin has made it clear that Russia's starting point for any kind of peace settlement in Syria should be a rump Syrian state around Bashar Assad.
So he's not looking
to really
kind of,
why he intervened. Yeah.
He's not looking to kind of control the phase out of Assad and put somebody else in power?
Well, it's perfectly plausible that that's something that they would contemplate along the way. I mean, the Russian government have hinted at that. But they've made it very clear that their starting point for any negotiation, any peace deal, you know, something that a truce is built on, is the assertion that Assad stays in place. They haven't said for how long. And, you know, Russia tends to be very pragmatic about these issues. I mean, it looks as though Putin is standing by his man. You know, if ultimately it becomes untenable, Putin's also not the kind of person who, you know, when he's in a hole, keeps on digging. He's always somebody who looks for a way out. That's actually one hallmark of Putin, you know, particularly from the perspective of being an operative. He never tries to close off any options. They're always, and that's why we find him so incredibly difficult to deal with. We can't sometimes figure out why he's tacking this way and that. He has some very firm principles that he sticks to, this being one of them. But he's always looking for an opportunity to change course because he tries to adapt as things change on the ground. So right now he's saying Assad, a rump Syria, you know, if we get a deal on that basis, you know, he may well change his mind as circumstances change later on. But he won't tell us that. And then that's, you know, he hints at it, but he won't say for sure because he never wants to lock himself into a position. Putin's the kind of person who doesn't want to get backed into a corner from which there's no way out for him. He always wants to think about his interests, the preservations of Russia's interests, and how he can have the maximum maneuverability.
Mm-hmm. So this truce now, this is a partial truce. They're going to be continue some bombing. Is that correct? Or is it still being decided?
Well, I think, you know, that's another hallmark of Putin. There's no such thing as, you know, anything permanent, particularly in terms of a ceasefire. We've seen this in Ukraine as well, where the violence is ticking back up again. I think truce is the right way to look at this. It's a way of, you know, basically freezing things on the ground to see if there's a way forward. I think it's very clear that Russia and Putin are looking for some kind of deal with the United States and with others about how to move forward. Putin, again, is very pragmatic. He knows that Russia cannot resolve all of the chaos in the Middle East right now. I mean, nobody can, certainly on their own. That there needs to be some kind of international framework for some negotiated settlement in Syria that also has a semblance of what kind of order we're looking at in the Middle East over the longer term. Mm-hmm. But he wants to make sure that Russia is at the negotiating table, mm-hmm. that Russia helps set that agenda and that all of Russia's interests are protected, because there's a lot of Russian interests in Syria, not least the fact that there are a lot of foreign fighters from Russia in Syria itself and a very large Muslim population in Russia that's indigenous to Russia, that Putin is also worried about becoming radicalized.
Becoming radicalized, right. Fiona, we only have a couple minutes left, but before we go, I wanted to get some more personal reflections from you. I should tell our listeners that you are fluent in Russian and that you have met Vladimir Putin and engaged him in conversation on several occasions. Could you say a little bit about that experience?
Yes, I mean, both of the very close encounters with Putin were in the context of a larger event where experts and analysts from Europe and the United States get invited to a multi-day session with Russian government officials, and including at several junctures Vladimir Putin and also Dmitry Medvedev when he was president. This began in 2004. It was set up by the Kremlin press office and continues. It's something called the Valdai Discussion Club. And on two of those occasions at the meetings with Putin, I was sat next to him, which gave me the opportunity to observe him close up. These sessions go on for hours. And I wouldn't say that we engaged in chit-chat. He's not that kind of guy. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody would be surprised about that. Putin doesn't really want to give anything away. I mean, I have to say that he was incredibly controlled. Sitting next to him, you know, even his facial expressions, everything is held in check. You know, he doesn't make eye contact unless it's absolutely necessary. He, you know, is very clear about, you know, maintaining his physical space around him. He makes very sparse notes. He doesn't really eat or drink anything, you know, when you're at a meal, which is, I have to say, a bit off-putting, you know, when
That's
he's sitting right next to him. And, you know, he's very, as I said, everything is very controlled. All of his appearances are very orchestrated, which, you know, tells you something. This is not a spontaneous politician. I mean, everything about Putin is calculated for effect. And I discovered that one of the reasons that I was sitting next to him was also calculated for effect, according to all the press people that I spoke to. He prefers to be seated in these kinds of occasions between women. One of his press secretaries was on the other side because we don't distract away from him.
Oh,
so in fact, I was like wallpaper.
Well, that's an amazing experience, Fiona. Unfortunately, we are out of time. We're all going to be watching President Putin in the future to see what he does next. I'd like to thank our guest, Fiona Hill, for joining us this morning. Fiona, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we appreciate it. That's Fiona Hill. She's senior fellow and director on the Center on United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. She's co-author of the book, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. Fiona will be giving a public talk and book signing tomorrow evening at 6:30 p.m. at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.